Because I didn't want to give him a complex. Are we ready? Okay.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Reardon. I'm opening a meeting of the House Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee on Thursday, February 9th, 2017. I want to welcome everyone here. We appreciate your participation. And similar to Tuesday's hearing, there are no LC drafts for introduction today. So we will skip the work session for possible introduction of committee measures and move right into today's agenda, which is largely focused on the intersection between veterans and higher education. And before I forget, as a veteran, I want to thank the veterans in the audience and active service members for your service. Greatly appreciated. Thank you. Where we at? Okay, I'm opening an informational hearing. Veterans and Higher Education Policy in Oregon. Director Smith.
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I have brought up my lifeline of all things student veterans for our department, Mr. Gus Bedwell, a former OSU student veteran coordinator and a real expert on our efforts for student veterans. Want to give just a high-level overview here this afternoon at the start of the committee to that crossover between the work of your higher ed and workforce committee and for this specific and unique population of student veterans. And we do have some nice crossover leadership with the chair of the committee, a five-year Navy veteran, a submariner, four-year, Vietnam-era veteran, but your vice chair has you beat with a 27-plus-year Air Force career and also a Vietnam veteran with Representative Wisnett. So thank you for your service. And we always start out, we have submitted kind of an overview two-pager that talks about our veterans landscape and our department at a high level. But where we any success that we have as a department is because of the Oregonians that we serve, our veterans and our military families. One out of every 12 Oregonians is a veteran, over 326,000 across the state. And large, you know, we're proud of our home loan program, our two skilled nursing facilities, but one of our largest missions is those veteran service officers as advocates in the corner of those veterans as they access their what are largely their federal VA benefits. And beyond just the good of standing up for our veterans and their families, it is a huge economic impact drawing down those federal VA dollars back into the state. And where we often start is also with the strengths of our veterans, their skills that they gain in their military service, their leadership, their core values, but also an honest assessment of the impact of war and the impact of what can be a very challenging reintegration back home. And given that robust now post 9/11 GI Bill, often that reintegration is happening on our community colleges and university campuses. You can see in 2003, when Iraq and Afghanistan was just kicking off, only $31 million of GI Bill dollars coming back into Oregon veterans on an annual basis, now upwards of $145 million for the fiscal year, for the calendar year 2015. So almost on a biennial basis, almost $300 million of scholarship resources, both for tuition fees, now a housing stipend, and also for books and supplies. Over 10,000 Oregon students, student veterans using the GI Bill every year. With those robust benefits, we know we could be doing more to support them and their student success on campus to make sure we get the bang for those federal dollars. Already in this early session, have some good momentum off of some longstanding relationships that we have through ODVA and our partners down to the student veteran centers and the student veteran coordinators, where our link to the county VSOs and our statewide veteran service officers, they're largely that advocate in the corner of the veteran for their disability, for their health care benefits. But those student veteran coordinators on campuses are the advocates to help navigate whether on the front end as they're enrolling, as they're registering, getting credit for their military service, to supporting them during, The student veteran coordinators aren't necessarily submitting benefits back to the Fed VA like the CVSOs, but they are that hub of the wheel of the campus linking back out to the county VSOs. And then on the back end, as we launch them with a certificate or graduation with a degree on their next mission, charging the hill forward for the rest of their civilian career. So Senate Bill 143 was already heard on the Senate side. Senate vets will be going over to House veterans. It may come back across to the House and Senate higher ed committees or education committees, or just go on to Ways and Means. But it would be positioning ODVA to have a grant program better supporting those student veteran centers and student veteran coordinators. Just like we've seen campuses stepping up for women students and the women's centers, first-time college families getting that support, making sure we're supporting our student veterans to get those outcomes out of their GI Bill benefits. And what will be a very difficult budget, generally given the budget hole for all state programs, that Ray of Sunshine is that Measure 96 of the lottery dollars to better serve veterans, was unanimous and bipartisan House Joint Resolution 202 passing out of the last February session. Then November general election, 84% of Oregonians voted to approve dedicating 1.5% of net lottery revenues to better serve veterans. So in the governor's budget, while we have significant increases for the county VSOs and our core work at ODVA, also looking to better mobilize partnerships specifically around student veterans, but also mental health and housing. So I am happy to stop there and take any questions and see what questions you may have.
Thank you, Director, for your thank you, Director, for your comments. We're talking about education here in this committee, so I'll be can you comment? I've gotten a lot of emails from veterans about the governor's budget reduction in your operations. Are you having conversations with the governor? Is there a chance that that will be changed?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, members of the committee. So in our agency request budget that we submitted in August, well before the lottery measure vote, and then the governor's budget recommended budget came out December 1, with a significant increase of total funds, but with a reduction of general funds. So today we're about $10 million general fund. And going down in the governor's budget to about $2 million general fund, and the rest a significant increase of those lottery dollars. And certainly, I think many of the legislators and other community partners have heard the veterans' voice loud and clear that they believe those dollars to be, the lottery dollars to be, above and beyond and supplemental. And the tension for both the governor's budget and ultimately for the legislature and Ways and Means to decide on that central question of how much of those Measure 96 dollars are going to be new and supplemental efforts in addition to the general fund. Right now, the co-chair's framework, after hearing from a lot of those veterans, have added some, it appears to have added back some to about $5 million general fund. And it's, from our level, we simply, we're reluctant to become a solely lottery-funded agency. It has the same dynamics of up and down that we see on the general fund side. So having that diversity of funding streams will be important going forward. We do feel fortunate for the governor's support in her budget. It is a significant increase, but not as significant as the full funding of lottery being new dollars.
Follow up. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's still going to be hard to explain that to the veterans. I supported a tax increase to the document fee that was an extra $5 after I voted for a $15 document fee for affordable housing, and I voted for a $5 document fee increase for veterans, especially shelter. And as the director knows, our World War II, our Korean, and our Vietnam population is getting into time in their life where they really need help. As you said, I thought it was higher than 78% voted for the measure, and I don't think they thought that that was to be balanced out by cutting the operating fund of the Veterans Administration. I assure you that myself, and thank you for recognizing, thank you for your service, but I think myself and a lot of members of this chamber will be continuing to push the governor. I understand that's your boss, command and control, but I think we don't consider any cut to the veterans to be acceptable after the people spoke as strong as they did for that measure. I think that it's, you know, I can give all sorts of sayings. I won't do that, and I won't take my committee's time or your time, but I don't think the body or the people support the governor on this, and I hope she'll come around. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't feel selfish in asking for these resources for the veterans and advocating for more, because one of the reasons that we got it out of last February session, unanimous and bipartisan, was that it wasn't solely positioned to be ODVA's budget. So I don't feel like it's solely to ODVA's benefit. Where this can augment the county VSOs, where it can augment the service organizations, or where it can pass through to community colleges and higher ed institutions, or mental health partners, or housing and homelessness prevention. It is a broader network that are serving veterans beyond just ODVA, for sure.
One more question. Thank you. May I have it?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came in this building, and we didn't have veteran service officers in Everett County. And under Republican leadership in 2005, we did say that Everett County will have at least one full-time veteran service officer. And I'll continue to support that. I think that's really important to be there where the veterans are. With the veteran service officers. Director and I have talked in the past about the medical care, and I don't think we've solved this issue. We still have a lot of veterans across the mountains, which is a real chore, and so I hope the veterans will not only be looking for education, I'm a supporter of that. I have a bill that will be introduced about, and this committee, I think if the chair agrees, will be working, that's employment of people with disabilities, including military veterans. That's education to get employment, or employment to get education is important. So I hope your office will be supportive of that. Thank you.
Other questions? Yeah, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your testimony, you mentioned the existence of some kind of support personnel at various colleges and universities to help vets navigate the landscape. Could you talk a little bit about that, just how many individuals you might be talking about and how they are distributed?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'll turn over to Gus Bedwell to give some of the perspective on the student veteran coordinators that are out there.
So, first, to begin, at each community college, university, public community college, university, there is one veteran certifying official at a minimum who takes care of the certifying your education benefits to the federal VA. That's not the positions we're talking about, because those positions just do that connection, that liaison work between the federal VA and the student when it comes to their education benefits. The coordinators that we're talking about are the examples that we have, like at Western Oregon University, Oregon State University, Portland Community College, Clackamas Community College, to name just a few. There's a few more across the state. And their main focus is to help the veteran navigate the process of getting into the school. So it's the enrollment, it's the admissions, it's that type of thing. But they also help them while they're at the school. So if they need housing, if they need food assistance, if they need an understanding of how to talk to their professor about an appointment with the VA, you name it, you think of it as a student that you may need, and then you may need as a veteran. That's what this coordinator is there, as a resource to either get you connected or advocate for you while you're at the school. One of the things that's really big about coordinators is they don't duplicate what the veteran service officers do. So their main role is, if somebody wants to file for those other benefits, the service-connected compensation or health care, that type of thing, they make a network in partnership with the veteran service officer to either come on campus and do that with the veteran, or they get them connected with that office. And in most cases, it's a warm handshake. It's not a, here's a phone number, call them. It's the coordinator picking up the phone and going, hi, this is Kim from PCC, and I have somebody who needs to get your services. Can I make an appointment for them next Tuesday? That type of thing. And it's just helping them in that process when they're at school. And then the next step is, as they leave school, connecting them to employers, connecting them to employment department, career services, that type of thing. So they're really that person on campus that helps them throughout the entire process. And when you combine that with a Veterans Resource Center, where there's a group of students who can come together and assist each other with tutoring and books and that type of thing, it creates an environment where the student feels supported while they're going through the process.
follow-up?
Yes.
So that sounds great. Sounds like a great program. You mentioned PCC and a few other institutions, but if I have a constituent in Hood River that wants to attend Columbia Gorge Community College, would they know who to contact that could help them navigate the process like you just outlined?
So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Columbia Gorge is one particular school that I know that they have a veteran certifying official, but they, to my knowledge, they don't currently have a Veterans Resource Center or a coordinator. So the main person they would connect with would be the certifying official. The level of knowledge that certifying official may have is dependent upon their exposure to VA, you know, related stuff. It may be just, I only know how to do the certifying piece of it. And so chances in that kind of situation, what they would do is they would refer them out to Tricia Stevens or Russell Jones, the two county VSOs in those two particular counties that that school falls into.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Rep. Belanco, Leon.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to comment on that level of work. My brother is a Marine veteran and went to PCC, graduated from PCC, and then went on to PSU and has his bachelor's degree in business. Very proud of him, very proud of the work he's done. And thank you for your service. I completely support the notion of having student veteran coordinators helping people navigate the education system. There's an assumption that when you go to college, you're supposed to know what to do.
Right.
And that is not so. No. And the education system, especially in higher ed, can be complicated and overwhelming if you don't have that experience. So having somebody guide you and provide you a safe handoff, mm-hmm. I think it's imperative. Absolutely imperative. And then on top of that, having our veterans come back home and trying to rebuild their lives and their families, I completely support this notion of having student veteran coordinators. But I also I appreciate Representative Johnson asking, do other community colleges have these resources?
Right.
And I'm assuming they may not have it because of lack of finance or resources, and we should have these resources across all of our universities and community colleges. It's important, but I just wanted to acknowledge that I completely support this type of programming.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's going to be different model. You know, what works at PSU with a much larger veterans population than out in the Gorge, it might be a student veteran who's on a VA work study that becomes that student veteran coordinator at a smaller school. But these dollars, the potential for these dollars could help grant and inspire whether to start a center or to be able to fund that coordinator position.
I just have one question. When we talk about guidance in a community college, for example, we have so many students that are, you know, first time into the college system, first member of their family to go to school, they're in poverty, they're working six jobs and all sorts of challenges. And then we have veterans who are probably facing the same issues. Can you help me understand, would you see this as an integrated counseling service or adding, or are there two separate guidance systems, or how would that work?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it's complementary. Often our younger veterans aren't always coming back and raising their hands for those. There are more benefits out there for veterans than any other segment of our population, but often they aren't raising their hands for them. So having that student advocate or an advocate in the corner of those student veterans, they're going to be making that link over to the CVSOs on disability claims, helping them navigate that healthcare system. But what the county VSOs don't often have is that luxury of being embedded on the staff or faculty of the institutions to help navigate within. So we see them as complementary. And just to kind of show the
possibilities, whether it's around student veterans or our aging veterans or different segments of our women veterans often aren't raising their hands for benefits. National Guardsmen sometimes don't identify for those same benefits. We're proud of off of disability compensation, which is cash coming back into the bank accounts and wallets of veterans and their families, $1.3 billion coming back every year to just in cash benefits from FedVA disability payments. Oklahoma, with about the same number of veterans as Oregon, has gone out and found about 20,000 more that are service-connected disabled. That works out to be another $500 million that they're drawing down over what Oregon's drawing down. Again, could be $1 billion impact, and many of those folks are going to be falling onto state or local safety net services that are general funded. So bringing more of those benefits and FedVA dollars back and saving on the general fund side could be a double win, not just for the veterans, but also the state budgets and local budgets overall.
Sounds good. And I forgot to ask you to introduce yourself for the record, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gus Bedwell. I work as a training and development specialist for Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, specializing in working with veteran service officers and VA education.
Okay. Thank you very much. And Rifke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for coming today. My question may seem like I'm an antagonist, but it's just for information so I can understand, because I'm not familiar with what you do. So my question is, that the services that these coordinators provide for veterans, is that what's the unique need of a veteran compared to just a regular student off the street? And it may be great and vast, and that's what I'm looking for, is to try to understand the difference between those two.
So I was thinking about that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I was thinking about that earlier and just giving you a little description of what a coordinator would do on campus. In my role as a coordinator on campus, you know, I did a number of things that affected student veterans. It was information like when the Department of Defense sent out a memorandum of understanding that dealt with how to navigate around the military tuition assistance, I would sit with the president and his leadership and describe to him what that meant, how that affected students, how many students, what did it affect if we didn't sign it at Oregon State University, and that type of thing. Then, you know, we talked about student veterans earlier who may be having challenges with you know, homelessness or poverty or that type of thing. There are programs on each one of these universities and community colleges. Some of the bigger ones have bigger programs, obviously. It really depends on what's available there. But it's networking with those individuals and saying, hey, I know you have, for instance, at Oregon State University, they have a daycare subsidy for their students. And they also have a daycare right there on campus that students can utilize. So it's getting connected with the daycare and child care provider to either access the subsidy out in the community or getting access to the daycare there on campus, and also finding out where some of the locations for a recent, you know, a mother who's recently had a child who needs to take care of her baby throughout the day, you know, finding those locations on campus. In addition, you have student veterans that are coming back with their own unique challenges of just being a combat veteran or being a military person in general and that experience and navigating through that. And so sometimes it's having that other person who's like-minded to be able to discuss, and having a safe space on campus to where you can get away and you can discuss your thoughts and what you're feeling. And, you know, for instance, the average student that's a military veteran on a university is between the ages of 22 and 25, okay. First-year student. Yeah. The average first-year student at a university that's non-veteran is between 18 and 19. Yeah. Can you imagine some of the differences in their own experiences just in that? And then the last thing I would offer to you is these veterans are coming home, and they're accessing VA system, and they're having to attend appointments that are going to make a significant change in their life for compensation and that type of thing. And so going as an advocate to a professor to explain to them that when this student comes to you and says, throughout the term, I have 3 or 4 appointments, I must attend or I'm not going to get my benefits, there's a reason behind them saying that. They're not just making this up. There's some reality behind it. And so getting that culture on campus amongst the professionals to understand who are the student veterans and what they have to offer and why they are different, but in a good way and in a positive way.
Quick follow-up? You work at Oregon State then?
I did work at Oregon State University from 2009 to approximately 2014.
Not a Ducks fan, are you?
No, I was just going to give him a gold star. So thank you.
Go Beavs.
Yeah. Chair, members of the committee, I would also add, that was an excellent answer from Gus, but I would also add there's a more, when, you know, 10% of the able-bodied citizens that served during World War II, everyone had a fellow family member or friend in the service. There's a sense now that when you have less than 1% serving in uniform, a growing civilian-military divide. So even just that, I mean, that you have those strengths as a veteran coming home, but how do you translate those skills into that civilian side is often a challenge when launching them off of campus into the world.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Rep. Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your service and your testimony. I have a slightly tangential question, and I wanted to ask you if by mentioning the concept of safe spaces at college, that you support the concept in general.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Well, again, thank you so much for coming in. Very helpful. It's a great information and good lead in to our Veterans Day series of bills we have. So,
thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I'm closing the informational hearing. And we're going to change the schedule just a little bit to accommodate Representative Witt's schedule, and so we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2565 at this time. Laura, would you please provide the committee with a brief summary of the bill?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2565 would modify the priority enrollment system to offer course registration to continuing qualified students prior to continuing non-qualified students within the same credit year classification. Requires public universities and community colleges to accommodate priority registration for new qualified students as practicable pursuant to institutional orientation requirements.
Okay. Representative Witt, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Brad Witt, state representative from House District 31, appearing before you this afternoon in support of House Bill 2565. This is actually a successor bill to House Bill 2645 of the 15 session. And if you'll bear with me a minute, it would probably be helpful to cover briefly a little bit about that bill so that we better understand why the present bill. The thinking behind the 2015 bill was one that how could we better help veterans and active military personnel in the state of Oregon to obtain higher education, in essence, associate's bachelor degree. And a lot of the challenges facing our military folks are the result of, frankly, their lives just being further along than the average college student who might come fresh out of high school. They're married, they have a job, they have a family, on and on and on and on. There may be some challenges that they face as a result of their military service, a host of issues, all of which is just so many more challenges to being able to attend college. So the notion was that we provide these individuals with preference so that when they go to school, they're able to not only pick the courses, but maybe the times. Maybe someone who has a job, they can't attend the 8 a.m. Economics 100, but they could do it at night. And that may be heavily subscribed. The preference might be helpful there to assist them in attending school. I can tell you that the burden of this bill was very significant for our colleges and universities. I and others who succeeded in passing this legislation with higher ed's assistance added an incredible amount of work for folks. We have now layered on one more level of preference, and we're beginning, perhaps, to pyramid preferences. This is not an easy thing for these institutions to necessarily be able to accommodate, but they did it, and they have done a fabulous job trying to make sure that veterans and active military in the state of Oregon had the benefit of higher education. My hat is off to all of our community colleges and universities. But as I said, number one, we have created a significant burden and scheduling process problems for them. Number two, a matter of human nature, if we provide someone an opportunity, whether that opportunity was in, we intended to confer that opportunity or not, read possible loophole, there are always folks who will try and take the possible to the extreme. Through because of that creativity, hypothetically, we could. What does preference actually mean? And as someone who's operating college admissions, does that then mean that if someone were to come in and say, "Well, you know, I have preference. Maybe I'd like to graduate from college in 2 or 3 years instead of 4." How far do we push the preference? If I want to take all of my required coursework in one term or semester, do we have to do that? And how then are we able to meet the needs of all the other students who have to enroll in these same colleges? Back to the original intent of the 2015 bill. It was to make sure that we provided an opportunity for folks to gain an education. The preference was to enable that to happen. It wasn't to go to an extreme. So the purpose, I think, in 2645 is to try and bring us back to put some sideboards on this, so that the institutions who are trying to do the job and do the education can actually do it, so that we make this a workable solution for them. I correct myself. House Bill 2565 of this session. With that in mind, I think the true intent of this bill, as I said, is to place the sideboards, so that the individual could presumably meet all the required courses, get through school in what I think most of us would consider a normal 4-year process for a baccalaureate, and to recognize that we have to find that balance between the need for education and the need for the folks who are providing that education to be able to have a system that works for them too. And because of that, I fully recognize, as the original sponsor, that need. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would ask for your consideration to assist in completing the original intent. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Witt? Rep. Johnson.
Yes. Thank you, Representative. Appreciate the bill. Could you maybe just give us some specifics, or some real-life examples of what colleges and or universities have encountered in trying to comply with the bill that we passed, just to help the members understand the reason for what you're trying to do, which I think is a good idea.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think the witnesses that will be following me will be perfectly situated to be able to do precisely that.
Thank you, Representative.
So.
And thank you for supporting our veterans and all of our students. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Okay. And I'd like to call up Rebecca Mather, registrar, and are they coming up together? And Donald Phillips, if you'd like to join. welcome to the committee. If you remember to introduce yourselves, appreciate that when you first speak. And whoever wants to go first is welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Donald Phillips. I am a Army veteran of 4 years. I was a medic who did one tour in Iraq during the 2009-2010 year. I am also a recent graduate from Oregon State University, where I used the GI Bill post 9/11, and currently pursuing my master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. The issues I would like to address about the bill in its current state are twofold, one of which has to do with the time frame the post 9/11 GI Bill has, which is the most widely used of the GI Bill versions, and the second is with readjustment while attending a university. Most schools see full-time as 12 credit hours, but to finish a bachelor's degree in the 36 months that are allotted to you by the post 9/11 GI Bill, you have to take a minimum of 15 credits. Now, due to scheduling of courses, this doesn't always end up being 15, and sometimes you have veterans who are taking 12 credits one term and 18 credits the next term. It also limits what courses you are allowed to take, because the certifying officials can only certify classes that are within your degree plan. So sometimes you will have students in the STEM fields who are pursuing an engineering degree and taking 3 physics courses and just trying to figure out which one they are going to fail because they were not able to get into any other courses that term. I myself ran into a few different hiccups and terms where I was taking 18 credits a term. It seems to be kind of common. That's just my own personal experience. I can obviously not speak for all student veterans. The second concern is readjustment. Most of the veterans I met who were using benefits at OSU while I was attending and at Lynn Benton Community College, where I attended before, are pretty recently out. They're OIF, OEF veterans who within the past 3 or less years have gotten out of the military and are attempting to readjust to civilian life. And that's a big thing. Like, that's a big difference between other non-traditional students and student veterans. Not everybody comes back with the same things. Some people who are entering school are dealing with hypervigilance, PTSD, anxiety disorders, and certain stressors of just it's a lot less organized than what they're used to. Whereas you have a very specific set of, you know what's expected of you when you get up in the morning. It's not the same anymore, and that's really hard for some of them. And it adds another level of stress. So as they're trying to register, they're trying to figure out what classes they can take that fit into their schedule, that are also within their course. As previously mentioned, some of them are working jobs along with all of that, so they don't have as many options as some traditional students might have. It's like I said, it's not every veteran, but it's been a noticeable thing to me. I was the president of the Veteran Family Student Association at Oregon State University, so I did spend a lot of time talking to veterans and trying to find out what their experiences were going on at the school.
That's great. I think we'll just go ahead and take your testimony and see if there's any questions for either one of you.
Great. Thank you, Honorable Chair and esteemed members of the committee. Appreciate you allowing me to be here today. My name is Rebecca Mather, and I'm the University Registrar at Oregon State University. And Donald and I have worked together pretty closely for the past year, year and a half, in talking about how we can make priority registration for our veterans work at OSU. And after the legislation passed last year, we implemented it, but we also wanted to ensure that all of the veterans were able to get priority registration. And this occurred as a result of multiple conversations between Donald and additional veteran student leaders on our campus and the office I work in, the Office of the Registrar, as well as other leaders on campus. And what was really wonderful is that as a result of the legislation and the implementation that we did last year, we were able to allow new student veterans priority registration over other students. But we took that a step further, and in collaboration with our student colleagues, we were able to determine that students who are veterans and receiving veteran benefits, and also dependents who are receiving those benefits, would get priority registration. So we implemented that that on our campus just this past year, sort of ahead of this legislation. One of the things that we look forward to changing as a result of our support and hopefully the passage of this legislation is to extend that to all veterans. So right now, if a veteran is on our campus and they're not receiving veterans benefits, they do not get that priority registration because the focus was on what Donald talked about is that time frame that they had to use their veteran benefits. So the passage of this legislation will allow us to extend that to all veterans. And some of the reasons why that is important is that we might have veterans who run out of benefits, and they still have a few terms left, and they've got to get those last classes before they graduate. But we also have veteran students who are even receiving benefits, and they choose not to use those benefits in the summer because it doesn't necessarily give them quite the amount of oomph that it would during the academic year because of the way our summer terms are aligned and their shorter course periods. So a lot of our veteran students who are who are getting the benefits choose not to use them in the summer, and this legislation will allow them to still have priority registration during that period of time. So we believe it will be a benefit to all of the students on our campus who are currently receiving that priority registration, but also in addition adding veterans who are not receiving benefits.
Could you tell us a little bit about how that prioritization was implemented? It seemed like it'd be quite a challenge. So,
yeah, you guys have a few hours? No.
Well, yeah. The results of it, not how you did it, but
absolutely.
What's it look like?
Just really briefly, the structure of actually creating our registration system each term for students to register takes about 5 weeks to get that all set up in our system. And that's the same for every institution. Sometimes the level of complexity at each institution will be different. It might take longer, shorter periods of time. And we wanted to make sure that we could implement this. So even though we agreed to do this last spring, we didn't actually get it implemented until actually registration for this past winter term. So it took us about 6 months to get that ready. But we had conversations with the student leaders. We got our senior leadership at our institution to approve it. But then it was actually it's a lot of just manual technical work in someone's office to create that. And so while we know that we're going to reopen that when and if this legislation passes and it will be additional work, we do believe that the outcome is worth it. But some of the things that sort of play into that, and especially if you're at a smaller community college or a small university where you don't have as many resources to work on this kind of thing, this particular legislation gives them the flexibility in how they do that will allow institutions maybe without as many resources to implement this new benefit. We have students who are taking prerequisites to get into the next class, and if they can't get into that class, they're stuck another term waiting to get that prerequisite so they can take the required course. We have students who we limit at Oregon State University, we limit all of our students in what we call phase one of registration to a certain credit amount so that the students who register first can't register for 22 credits and sort of take opportunities to get classes from others. So we do limit that. And then in phase two, after everyone's had a chance to get a minimum number of credit hours, we open it up further and we extend the ability for people to register. So for us, the complexity of how we set that up to ensure equity and fairness takes a lot of work and time. Sure. So I don't know if that helps.
It's just time sequence, basically, of when you allow people to access the system.
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you for coming. That sounds like a very time-consuming but very thoughtful process. Now, have you guys spoken to other institutions about what you think about this idea and would love to hear what kind of feedback you've received and what other institutions are considering or have done it?
I haven't really discussed
I can absolutely. So I haven't had extensive conversations at the community college level. I know that some offer priority registration for veterans right now, and some I'm not sure that they all do. But at the four-year conversation, our public institutions, I know that Portland State has now offers priority registration to all veterans. I know that University of Oregon is operating within the within the parameters of the current legislation. We're sort of somewhere in the middle where we've, you know, we've gone above and beyond the current legislation, but we're moving forward with additional. And I believe our colleagues at Southern Oregon University offer priority registration to veterans. I can't speak to all the universities, but we do talk about it. We talk about how we can implement it in a way that makes sense and is also fair and equitable across institutions, because we do have students who transfer between mm-hmm. institutions, and we try to make the experience somewhat similar.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may.
Yes.
One thing about the bill, the current bill that's in is it offers priority registration for the first term that a veteran's attending. And myself and many other veterans that I've talked to feel that that is the least important term to have priority registration, because when you walk in your first term, you have 180 credits to pick from that you have to fulfill. And after that, your scope just gets more and more narrow. So it's the further terms that the priority registration becomes more important when you're getting into the 400 level, 300 level classes that have much smaller seatings. You're not trying to get into a 400, like a class with 400 people in it.
So are you suggesting we need an amendment? Or?
Well, I think that's the purpose of the new bill.
Okay.
That's going right. forth, is it?
Thank
basically.
You.
Here.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I plan to write the president of OSU and compliment him on his support of your leadership and going beyond what we ask you to do. And I'll probably info the other presidents on that letter. So thank you for going beyond what's asked to do for veterans, including those that are not getting paid to go to college. Thank you.
Yes. Alonzo.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to, I guess, comment on the importance of having a student veterans coordinator and having the institution work together to help the student be successful, particularly because it is not as easy as people think on how to navigate and how to select courses associated to your career and all the changes that happen, the new policies around new courses that you need to take in different career fields. So it's imperative to have really good coordination. So I agree with my colleague here. Thank you for taking that leadership, but it sounds like there's more.
The Military and Veteran Resource Center at OSU has been an invaluable resource to myself, and while I worked there, many veterans came through, and we helped them figure out stuff, not just with school, but with other aspects of their life that were adding stressors while they were attending OSU.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, I think that is one thing that not all schools have the funding to offer, and that is detrimental to those institutions and the students, the veteran students who are there. If you have veterans who are receiving benefits, you automatically are going to have a certifying official on your campus. You need to do that in order for them to get the benefits. But the work that they do is so different from the advocacy work that a coordinator can do to actually help the student be successful sort of holistically and outside of the classroom as
yeah.
well. So the work is very different, and it's, in my opinion, it's critical, and at Oregon State we found it to be extremely successful.
Yeah, Rep Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming. So I'm sometimes a little slow, especially in the afternoon, especially as we get towards the end of the day. So my question is, again, from what I'm hearing, is the bill in 2015 only gave prioritization to the first term, or the first registration counted as first term, but after that, so you could take writing 121, but writing 122 would not give you priority, and like you said, in the 300 and 400 level. Is that correct?
There's a little nuance to it.
Okay.
It actually gave veterans priority registration over all new students, right?
Okay, right,
so,
right.
So for all veterans, whether they were new or continuing, mm-hmm. they were guaranteed priority registration over other new students.
But just
so
in the first term or the first quarter, or is it?
Well, the way it worked, I mean, so at every institution that looked a little bit different, right? Mm-hmm. So if you didn't have any sort of structured priority registration at your institution, you then did create a structure so that those veterans would get priority registration over new students every single term. But at Oregon State, for instance, we already had a priority structure. So the only term that those veterans might not be in front of other students was that first term, because then they were automatically in front of other new students, if that makes sense.
Okay. Thank you.
Your chair has recognized that I've not done a very good job of time management, and all of these hearings are fascinating. They really are, and we all want to know everything. So unless there's a burning question, I think we need to close this hearing. Any burningness going on? No. Okay. That's good. Was there anybody from the public? I'm sorry. Thank you for coming. Your testimony has been very helpful.
Did you take this out?
Anybody from the audience? I don't think we did, right? Okay. I'm closing a public hearing on House Bill 2565. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2220. And Laura, would you please provide the committee with a brief summary of the bill?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2220 would remove the requirement that veterans must not have graduated high school due to service in the armed services for issuance of a high school diploma. It removes the requirement that veterans must have received general educational development certificate, post-secondary degree, or a minimum score on the armed services vocational aptitude battery for issuance of a high school diploma.
Thank you very much. And we have Representative, our very own Representative Wisner.
It's required that he goes down there?
It's preferred.
Oh.
We okay?
Yeah.
Bear with me. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Gene Wisner, State Representative, House District 53. Mr. Chair and honorable colleagues, thank you for hearing this bill today. It came from a constituent, and I think his letter is in the OLUS provided for you. He asked me to look into this and help him, and I think his letter is very descriptive of the situation. Department of Education is available for clarification. They're neutral on the bill, as they have to be, but I appreciate their work and support in this bill. It was brought to my attention by a constituent that you have his letter, and it's very important and very personal. Each of you have, each of us have stated how much appreciation we have for our veterans and the sacrifice they've made to our country. And this is another bill that gives us opportunity to really do something about how we feel about them. Currently, some veterans are denied the ability to request a high school diploma, either because their service has not been the sole reason they did not complete high school or because they did not have a GED or post-secondary degree. As a result, was the case with Michael Chateau, veterans in our state who had essentially earned their diploma except for technicalities and could not obtain one after their service has concluded. So I'm going to summarize very quickly. What this bill does is eliminate some of the requirements you used to have to do to get a high school diploma. You had to have a GED or these things. And the bill's pretty clear. If you look at the bill, it shows you the things in italics are coming out. So basically now, to get a high school diploma, you only had to attend a high school before serving in the armed forces. You had to serve in the armed forces and receive an honorable discharge. And it lists the conflicts or the period you have to serve. So a good thing for our veterans. I think their training as a military person and their performance fulfills the needs to be awarded a high school diploma. So I urge you to support this bill and help our veterans. So one of the key things is even a GED, I'm sorry, Representative Leon, it sometimes hurts them in trying to get a job, so they want the high school diploma.
Can I respond? No, I absolutely, as a former GED administrator, our priority was always to help support anybody who wanted to earn their high school diploma. That was a priority. The GED is a test that is equivalent to the high school diploma for whatever reason, if there were barriers to them earning their high school diploma. So certainly, I agree that high school diploma is a priority and the GED is there to support those to continue their education.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Could you give us a little history on there was a certain time period when the military started requiring a high school graduation degree to enter the military? Isn't that true? So bill would apply to people prior to that?
Mr. Chair, thanks for the comment. Economics 101. When there's plenty of people volunteering for the service, they can make the requirements more difficult. And I don't know exactly the time, but right now they do require a high school diploma to get in. This is talking about on getting out, but yes, sir.
I see lots of head shaking in the back.
The requirement for high school diploma goes up and down, and it's not the same for all services. I'm sorry. Where's my veterans? He left us. The Marine left us, but the veterans have a high, and the Air Force have a high requirement for education. But it depends on the supply and demand, and the how many people we're getting to volunteer for. All volunteer Air Force, military.
The only question I needed to ask was how did you give consideration to the length of time somebody should be in high school before, and is that a relevant question?
It wasn't it wasn't in the original bill. I just said you. And they had all these different conditions here we see that you could with substitute. This makes it simple. There's no requirement, no, sir.
Other questions? Comments? Yeah. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Just a nice question, Representative.
Softball. Tip-off's coming up.
Will we hear from ODE or OSBA or any other education folks about their opinions on this?
Mr. Chair, may I answer?
We will.
Yeah. Well, they're available. They said they have to be, they have to be neutral on the bill.
We have a lineup.
They helped. Jan McCombs was very helpful in researching this and offered some suggestions for me.
Okay.
And so it's they do not oppose it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I think you're off the hook. Thank you very much. And can we call everybody up together, you think?
Okay.
Okay, I'd like to call up Jason Brewer, Jan McComb, and Andrea Morgan. Oops. So he's just fine. Okay. So is Jason Brewer here?
Jason couldn't come.
He couldn't. Oh.
He letter the record.
Jason Brewer is not with us today. So, but we do have two folks from the Oregon Department of Education. Would either of you like to comment?
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, Jan McComb, the legislative director for the Department of Education, and with me is Andrea Morgan. Andrea wears a lot of hats at the department, but one of them is taking questions about diplomas and veterans, and that's why she's here today to back me up.
Okay.
So as Representative Wisnett said, we are neutral on the bill. This will mainly affect older veterans. Andrea, do you want to talk about some of the phone calls you get?
Okay. Chair Reardon and committee, I'm Andrea Morgan. I'm an education specialist at Oregon Department of Education. And the calls that I get about this bill typically deal with older veterans because of that very idea that you talked about earlier, that now most of our people enlisting have to already have their diploma before they're allowed. But I get calls where employers want to give a promotion to a veteran who didn't have a high school diploma, and because of the company's policy, they can't get the promotion because they don't have a high school diploma. The employer says they're absolutely qualified, they're the person we want, we want to move them on, but the policy says without a diploma, they can't have the promotion, or they can't be hired, or other barriers are there. And so typically, like I said, this is older veterans, Vietnam, a little bit after that, so already in an age group that has difficulty with employment. And so this gets rid of some of the barriers and makes it easier to determine who should be awarded these, because we also have times when we have to really think about what was the timeline of when they left high school and entered the military and do all of that. And I think this just makes it a lot cleaner.
Other questions or comments? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go on record as saying I appreciate the testimony you just gave, because I'm in favor of policies that keep people working, allow them to advance, and address inequities in our system, especially as we analyze what was relevant at the time, what was really happening at the time, and what are the special circumstances. So especially being able to support people remaining employed, moving up in the workforce ladder, and supporting their families, you'll always have my wholehearted, strong support for that. So, thank you.
Any questions or comments? I just have to say that I think back on the education, the experience that I had in 3 years, 9 months, and 0 days that I served, and you know, totally changed my life. And I don't think unless someone has done that, you can really understand the value of that new worldview that you have. And I had all kinds of technical training on top of it that certainly would support this myself. So I think we've had enough testimony. You're getting off easy today, but thank you so much for coming in. It's really important work.
Thank you.
And thank you, Rep. Wisnett, for bringing us to our attention, bringing this bill to us.
They did a good job.
Of course they did. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2220. And we just picked up 5 minutes. Good job. Okay. Oh, shuffled the wrong paper. Okay, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2488. Laura, would you please provide the committee with a brief summary of the bill?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2488 would require the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to adopt rules prioritizing award of Oregon Promise Program grants to persons serving in the Oregon National Guard who have completed initial active duty training.
Hey, thank you. And we have Representative Cliff Bentz, and I think everybody could come up. Would that be all right with you, sir?
Chair, for the record, State Representative Cliff Bentz, District 60, and I'm going to testify very quickly and then zoom down to another meeting that I'm now late for, but I'm not that unhappy about that.
Okay.
So,
good. We're happy if you're happy.
Want me to go ahead?
Please.
Thank you. First of all, Mr. Chair, for hearing House Bill 2488, a concept that was brought to my attention by a recruiter in Ontario. As you just heard, the bill is a simple one, which would give priority to the Oregon National Guard members who have completed initial active duty training in the Oregon Promise. The hope is, of course, that it receives some funding so that this priority actually makes some difference. But it would be a very valuable thing for recruiting purposes, and I think that's why it was brought to my attention by the recruiting office. For what it's worth, and it's a little, my cousin, who many of you learned about when I carried a resolution on the floor for her some years ago, Major General Julie Bentz, back in Washington, D.C., is my only real link to the military, so I called her on this bill, and I said, Major General, what do you think about giving the Guard a leg up on this kind of educational opportunity? And she, of course, immediately said it was the best bill she had ever heard of and wanted me to know that and pass it on to you. It was a most interesting conversation, I must say, but she was totally serious. And so I think this would help a lot in attracting folks to the service and supporting them when they're there. So I appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill. And with that, if there are no questions, I'm going to zoom out the door to my other meeting. Okay.
I think we can leave the questions to the rest of the panel. And thank you very much for carrying this bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay, if Sergeant Dan Eggenbrud would come forward, and Dave Stuckey, and Master Sergeant Scott Simpson.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. I'm Dave Stuckey. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Normally, I am the next wall over in the House Veterans, and so it's nice to see all our services. They were here all represented, the Marines, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Army. And so the Army's going to go last, sir. We want to make certain that we cover all our bases. And this is really about a conversation on the front half or the beginning of a professional's life. And in this case, it's going to be a professional that enlists in the Oregon National Guard. And so We appreciate Cliff, Representative Bentz bringing this forward to us, and we were here for a technical, neutral position for the Oregon Military Department in this regard. We believe the bid offense will be positive should the legislation pass, and we look forward to working with HEC if this happens to go forward. This bill is really about two components. This bill is about prioritization as well as the six-month window that one must apply in current legislation to attend the Oregon Promise. And so we have two recruiters here today. One came, Sergeant Agenbrod, who this bill is a party to, had the desire and the initiative to call up Representative Bentz's staff out in Ontario. And so it was his brainstorm. We appreciate him bringing this forward. So he braved the storm yesterday to come out here. And so what I'd like to do is turn this over to these two soldiers right now, and then we can close this up with questions at the end, if that's okay with you, Chair.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Reardon and honorable members of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. I am Sergeant First Class Dan Agenbrod. I'm a recruiting and retention NCO with the Oregon Military Department. My assigned area is Malheur County and Harney County. House Bill 2488 was sponsored by Representative Bentz. After a discussion I had with his staff, I am both humbled and privileged to appear before you today. Again, the Oregon Military Department's official agency position is neutral on House Bill 2488. I'm here today to offer a recruiting perspective. Non-commissioned officers in the National Guard volunteer for recruiting duty in order to directly help the citizens of their local communities. Recruiters see membership in the National Guard as a great opportunity for the young people of their communities to improve themselves through the increased education benefits of the National Guard provides. This is also why the Oregon Promise appeals to many of the students that we talk to on a daily basis. One of the potential issues with the Oregon Promise and membership in the National Guard is our required training and the time that it requires. Currently, the Oregon Promise requires that students attend community college within 6 months of graduating. The current timeline for the Oregon Promise will prevent members from the Oregon National Guard from accessing the program due to the time requirements of initial entry training. Our training on average lasts anywhere from 3.5 to 12 months. There is also a 120-day mandatory wait from enlistment to ship date. Ship date depends on training seat availability, which is administered through the active Army. So, by military regulation, the individual soldier has 24 months to complete training. This 24-month time frame allows for the length of training, potential delays due to injury, illness, and/or recycle, and also the late training ship dates that are possible. Once training is complete by a guardsman, they return to the state ready to start their college education, but will have lost eligibility in the Oregon Promise because they have not started community college within the required six-month window. I currently have four guardsmen in my area and four applicants working towards joining the National Guard. They will all be impacted by the current law, one of which is Alicia Maldonado. She is a senior in Ontario High School right now. She joined the National Guard her junior year and actually attended basic training between her junior and senior year. She has since been accepted into Central Oregon Community College and Oregon State University and intends to attend the ROTC program to gain her commission as an officer in the National Guard. Her second phase of training starts September 21st of 2017. Central Oregon Community College's their fall term starts September 26th. So Alicia's second phase of training is 2 months in length, and we'll put her back in the state in time to start school for the winter term. She will be disqualified from using the Oregon Promise under the current law because of her inability to attend college within 6 months of graduation due to her membership in the National Guard. This bill before you will allow Private Maldonado and many other troops to maintain their eligibility in the Oregon Promise program. Thank you for your opportunity to meet with and discuss the issues facing our local guardsmen. I am happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Let's go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Reardon and honorable members of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. This is an awesome opportunity for us to be here to talk with you about this legislation, House Bill 2488. My name for the record is Master Sergeant Scott Stimson. I'm currently serving with the Oregon Army National Guard. I serve as a detachment chief. Basically, I oversee recruiting and retention production in the East Portland region, with over 10 years working with local high schools and community colleges in regards to young men and women looking to serve in the National Guard. I'm a local 2001 graduate from West Albany High School who went to Lynn Benton Community College, Western Oregon University, and most recently I graduated with my MBA from Oregon State University. So I'm Oregon homegrown and raised and have some experience with our high school and post-secondary education systems. As a senior leader in the Guard, I've seen how this affects our recruiters and their efforts, but more importantly, how it directly impacts our young recruits seeking a higher education. The Oregon Military Department's official agency position is neutral on House Bill 2488. From the recruiting support perspective, we think that this bill would create a win-win situation in helping today's youth that want to serve their community in the National Guard while being able to attend their local community college and get a degree. It resolves a small conflict of interest that currently excludes young servicemen and women from being able to take advantage of both opportunities through the Oregon Promise Program. The bill proposes a time waiver in Section 1, Subsection 7, that would allow Guard members who are required to complete their mandatory initial soldier and job training to return to Oregon and apply for the Oregon Promise. This is a very inclusive bill. As senior leaders in the Oregon Army National Guard, we want our citizen soldiers to be educated. It's mandatory for service members that they graduate from a high school or equivalency program. Both our state's Adjutant General and Component Commander support our soldiers' pursuit of a higher education. Overall, it's an investment in human capital and affects not only the end strength of our Oregon National Guard, but our soldiers' readiness to respond in emergency preparedness and disaster relief. This bill could positively influence Oregon's high school graduation rates, increase state college attendance, and add to our National Guard end strength. This not only makes us better, but smarter. Thank you, Chair Reardon, and honorable members of the House Committee for your time and consideration on this matter.
Question? Yes.
I just want to say thank you for your service, and I completely agree. I know that the GED students are mentioned here. What I think what happens with a lot of GED students is that they are graduating every single day. And so even if they weren't in the armed forces, some would not be eligible for the Oregon Promise. And so that's something that I think for our population that want to go into the armed forces, that's almost double a challenge. They earn their GED early on, within outside of the 6-month time frame. Now they want to serve our country, and then they still are not eligible for the Oregon Promise. So I get it. So I agree. We need to change the time frame. And make it more equitable and accessible, because that's the purpose of the Oregon Promise, essentially.
Thank you. Yeah. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. I was really, really involved in the Oregon Promise bill in the last session, so I know it really well. I want to offer a suggestion respectfully. There's a word in here that gives me pause, and it's the word prioritize, because I don't think it's necessary. Let me explain and why I'm worried about prioritize, because we've already heard, well, of course, first of all, it's a very, very successful program, you know that. We've got, I think, almost 7,000 students that are, you know, they have obtained the grant to help them, and they're enrolled right now at community colleges. One of the issues that has popped up recently, and maybe you've read some of the newspaper editorials, I think there's one from the Registered Guard over the weekend, but there is a little bit of angst because the population of those that is actually enrolled doesn't exactly mirror our high school graduation demographics, so, i.e., some people think that we need to change it and perhaps start means testing it so it only pertains to low-income students, which was not at all ever the legislative intent behind it, because frankly, this is one of the only college support or post-secondary supports available to middle-class students who would make too much to qualify for Pell. But yet, because they don't qualify for Pell, their average award is higher than other students who would qualify for financial aid and so forth. So, which leads me to say the word prioritized, in my mind, would open up the ability of other groups to come in and ask for other carve-outs too. I think we can accomplish what you're looking for by simply adding to that
enrollment time period, the 6 months that's in the bill. And the reason that's in the bill is because data shows that if a kid graduates from high school but doesn't get started very pretty quickly, their chances of being a successful student go down like this. So that's what the time frame is in there for. It's not to be discriminatory in any way. But if we simply added a criteria in there that obviously Oregon Air National Guard or Oregon National Guard members would also have that option regardless of when they would want to apply, so that the 6 months wouldn't apply to them, but they still would meet the academic requirements, right? You're not asking for that to be diminished, the 2.5 GPA in the graduate and so forth. So I think we could do the same thing. And it was frankly, it was something we thought about right after we passed the bill, that we should make an allowance in here, because obviously if you're serving, you're not going to be able to, you know, begin that college career within the next 6 month period anyway. So I'm not debating at all what your objective is. I think there might be a way we can get there with still preserving the original intent of the Oregon Promise. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson. Again, we're neutral. There's some technical adjustments that can be made to this.
Yeah,
we're looking at a cleanup potential here on that particular component. The prioritization piece, and that's really, there's really two pieces here, and the prioritization piece is really for this body and the legislature to decide. I just offer that any recruiting incentive, any recruiting type of activity that it goes for the National Guard helps us in the long runs in terms of how we do things. DOD budgets, when they get constrained, when the cuts start getting made, it always goes back to assigned strength, and it always goes back to how many soldiers and airmen do you actually have in your unit. We're right now on the Army side at about 93.7%. On the Air Force side, we're almost at 100%. The Air Force always has more sexy toys in it. But from our standpoint, we're racked and stacked against everyone else in the nation. And so the higher strength we are, the better we are, the more tools we are. And that's really kind of the logic behind it, sir.
Yeah. And just one other follow-up, if I could. And just to point out, you know, no one who met the criteria for the Oregon Promise was turned down.
Perfect, sir.
Thus far. I mean,
thank you.
One reason why the fiscal for this going forward, it will be a little larger than we originally intended. But the point is, it's being really effective, and it's accomplishing what we hoped it would, was provide an affordable pathway for students, so they're not shouldering a load of debt when they get their associate's degree and so forth, to make them available to advance their career and lives.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Representative Johnson? We've also seen that we need to make exceptions for the 6 months, and I definitely see that's what you're asking. We've done that, but we found out, what if you have mono? The FFA ambassadorship program, they spend a year after high school graduation before they enter college, so they wouldn't be eligible either. So there's a lot of, you know, this is the expert on the bill, but the 6 months, we need to make some, have waivers or some exceptions, and that would definitely be the Guard people that would come in that.
Thanks.
Chair Reardon?
Yes.
And I think I agree, and I think that just going back to making sure we, since this is an inclusive bill, that we consider our GED students who do graduate outside of the 6 months, because they're graduating every single day, and if they don't complete within this time frame, then they're not eligible. So we need to, I think, add that also addition to the exceptions.
I'm not going to be suggesting we work this for at least a week or so if you have some time to...
And I'll be happy to work directly with Representative Benz on an amendment. Is that okay with
you? You might.
Thank you.
You know, and having once felt the hot breath of the draft down on my neck, I really appreciate the idea of recruiting and being able to incentivize the recruiting process as opposed to a draft. So, really,
yes, sir.
Much
we agree.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I think that's it. Thank you so much again for your service, and thank you for coming in today. Super, very helpful.
Thank you.
Closing a public hearing on House Bill 2488. And I'm opening an informational hearing, we're going to have some great hearings next week. What we're going to do is introduce that topic a little bit today. We'll be taking a really in-depth look at the workforce system next week, and I want to point out you have before you a nifty handout that kind of illustrates the workforce system that we have today. This is actually the Oregon Workforce Investment Board part of it, to give you an overview of that. But basically, I'm going to just go through some quick comments, and we got a video, and we will get you out of here promptly on time. But basically, there are tens of thousands of Oregonians who need jobs, and there are companies all over the state whose growth is stymied because they cannot find skilled employees. We have many elements of strong workforce training system, and based on several conversations with people in the training system, there's a strong desire to improve, and actually they've been working to make improvements. So over the next several hearings, we will be hearing from members of the business community, the various agencies involved, educational institutions, and others involved, so we can really totally understand our current system. And then as we go through this, so I really I want you to join me in really examining this and really looking at, you know, what are within each of the half dozen or so agencies that provide workforce training, what are the roles and responsibilities? Where is there overlap? Where's there a gap in service? Where are there redundancies? And really take a look at that and see if we can in some way find ways to help really turn this kind of a siloed workforce system that we have. I shouldn't call it a system, a workforce
process.
I don't know. Collection of agencies that do workforce. How can we turn that into a real machine and really make it so that it's a strong economic force? Our workforce is a strong reason why companies would locate here, why they will stay in Oregon, and let's just help get people to work. I think everybody wants a job rather than a handout, and let's help them do that in a cost-effective way. So it's no small undertaking. This is several large bureaucracies we're looking at, but I think if we'll put our heads and our hearts into this, we can make some improvements. The agencies, everybody I've talked to, wants to do this work, and so we just need to figure out how we can help. So with that, we have a video somewhere. Going at a screen near you.
Oregon's workforce system is dynamic, and we are all part of it. The purpose of this presentation is to provide an understanding of Oregon's workforce system and our roles as individuals within that system. The workforce system is primarily funded through the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, or WIOA, which was signed into law in July of 2014. The law contains four separate titles that apply to the various programs we will discuss here. Opportunity Act funds are issued by Congress and allocated to three federal agencies: the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the U.S. Department of Education, and the U.S. Department of Labor. Each of these federal agencies further regulates the funding and monitors its use, respective to each agency's workforce programs. The funds are then distributed to each state and the appropriate state agencies. In Oregon, the core workforce system agencies are the Oregon Department of Human Services, the Oregon Employment Department, and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission's Office of Workforce Investments. Their activities are overseen by the governor and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is the overall advisory board to the governor on workforce matters. Each of these state agencies oversees one or more workforce programs throughout Oregon. In Oregon, the core workforce system agencies are the Oregon Department of Human Services, the Oregon Employment Department, and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission's Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Each of these state agencies administers one or more workforce programs throughout Oregon. Their activities are overseen by the governor and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, or OWIB, which is the overall advisory board to the governor on workforce matters.
Okay, give me this.
The Department of Human Services, or DHS, provides an array of services to Oregonians, including children's services, senior services, assistance services, and employment services. There are some essential assistance and employment programs that align closely with other workforce system initiatives. The Temporary Assistance for Needy Family Programs, or TANF, provides cash assistance to low-income families with children while they strive to become self-sufficient. The goal of the program is to reduce the number of families living in poverty through employment and community resources. The Job Opportunity and Basic Skills Program, or JOBS Program, is another DHS program that helps achieve this goal. The JOBS Program is Oregon's employment and training program for people on public assistance. Services provided through the JOBS Program include job search, work experience, JOBS Plus subsidized employment, support payments, and high school or GED completion for teen parents. Another primary program of DHS is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, called SNAP. A large percentage of Oregonians receive SNAP benefits, and some are able to participate in the SNAP employment and training component, known as the Oregon Food Stamp Employment and Training Program, referred to as OFFSET. The OFFSET program assists clients to gain valuable skills, training, or experience that will improve employment prospects, leading to self-sufficiency and reduced reliance on SNAP benefits. DHS also operates employment programs for special populations. The Senior Community Services Employment Program, CSEP, funded under the Older Americans Act, serves persons with low incomes who are 55 years old or older and have poor employment prospects. The workforce programs for people with disabilities are provided through the DHS Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, also called VR. VR is governed by Title IV of the WIOA and is a core workforce system program under the law. VR assists people with disabilities to get and keep a job that matches their skills, interests, and abilities. VR staff work in partnership with community and businesses to develop employment opportunities for people with disabilities. The Oregon Employment Department, referred to as OED, operates a public labor exchange responsible for connecting job seekers with employers. It supports economic stability for Oregonians and communities during times of unemployment through the payment of unemployment benefits, serving businesses by recruiting and referring qualified applicants to jobs, and providing resources to a diverse group of job seekers in support of their employment needs. OED also develops and distributes quality workforce and economic information to promote informed decision-making. The OED Workforce Operations Division is funded and governed by Title III of WIOA, also referred to as the Wagner-Peiser Act. OED is a co-owner of WorkSource Oregon and provides a large portion of staffing and physical infrastructure for Oregon's WorkSource centers and is responsible for shared system outcomes. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission, or HEC, houses the Office of Workforce Investments, called OWI, and the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, known as CCWD. The purpose of these offices is to contribute leadership and resources to increase the skills, knowledge, and career opportunities of Oregonians. On behalf of the governor, OWI oversees the state's implementation of and funding distribution for local workforce programs under Title I of WIOA, while CCWD administers Title II adult basic education programs. Title II of the Opportunity Act relates to the adult education and literacy programs in Oregon's 17 community colleges, which are an essential component of the education and workforce system. The purpose of the Adult Basic Skills Program is to assist adults in obtaining the knowledge and skills necessary for work, further education, family self-sufficiency, and community involvement. Basic skills include reading, writing, math, speaking and listening in English, GED and adult high school preparation, and basic computer literacy. Title I, Subtitle B, comprises workforce development activities that are directed by local workforce boards, known as LWIBs. Each state is divided into individual workforce areas that are designated by the governor, and every county is represented on their local workforce development board. Oregon has 9 local workforce areas, and each has a local workforce board. The local workforce boards are designated by the governor to develop local workforce plans and direct and prioritize funding toward workforce development activities. The LWIBs provide a convening table for labor, economic development, elected officials, education, workforce development, and human service providers to create community-based solutions to workforce challenges and efficiently address local labor market needs and statewide priorities. They lead employer engagement to promote business representation, develop linkages, implement effective strategies, and ensure workforce investments support the needs of employers. The local boards serve as neutral, independent brokers of workforce services. As such, they invest in workforce services across the state and purchase contracted services that are provided to support talent development, job creation, income progression, business competitiveness, and expanded opportunities for citizen prosperity. Services are provided to adults, dislocated workers, and youth. The majority of youth served are low income with complex barriers to employment. Youth services connect participants to career opportunities, training, and one-on-one support in order to prepare them for post-secondary education and career ladder employment. Youth gain the essential skills needed to be successful and self-sufficient. Local workforce boards are responsible for certification of WorkSource Oregon centers in their local areas. They are accountable for shared workforce system outcomes as co-owners of WorkSource Oregon. They negotiate local performance measures, and they conduct program oversight to ensure appropriate use, management, and investment of workforce resources. In partnership with the Oregon Employment Department and other agencies, contracted service providers within the WorkSource Oregon centers help customers learn new skills, find employment, and progress in careers, while also assisting employers with recruitment and retention of qualified, skilled employees. WorkSource Oregon is the primary vehicle for delivering workforce services across the state. The Opportunity Act requires that the Title III services provided by OED are co-located with other service providers, like the Title I-B contracted service providers, at one location. Co-location for other partners, such as DHS, is not required by law. Though the specific configurations may differ from one local area to another, WSO is comprised of multiple agencies and organizations. And while each of these entities may have their own missions, visions, and values, the mission, vision, and values of WorkSource Oregon have been developed to speak on behalf of the broader workforce system. The mission of WorkSource Oregon is to effectively respond to workforce challenges through high-quality services to individuals and businesses, resulting in job attainment, retention, and advancement. Our vision is that of communities where the employment needs of job seekers and businesses are met by solutions delivered effectively through engaged workforce system partners. Our guiding principles include inclusiveness, stewardship, excellence, teamwork, integrity, and relevance. To position the workforce system for relevance and growth, there must be clarity about what WorkSource Oregon is at both the state and local levels, what it offers, and how existing partnerships bear a shared responsibility to create value to additional partners in the future. Leaders from partner agencies were pulled together for a 3-day work session to develop that framework. The outcome is the WorkSource Oregon Operational Standards. They provide the minimum level content and services required to be available at all WSO centers. They also build in an accountability mechanism to ensure that this effort will come to fruition across the entire state. They offer an opportunity to work together to continually improve the system, engage new partners, and better serve Oregon's job seekers, workers, and businesses. At the local level, local leadership teams, or LLTs, are used to manage the implementation of the local WSO system. This includes coordination of services, programs, funding streams, processes, and initiatives among WSO partners to ensure accountability and alignment in support of a seamless public system. LLTs may consist of local board staff, the conveners, OED managers, center managers, contracted service provider management, and staff and representatives from engaged partners, programs, and stakeholders, such as DHS, VR, community colleges, and TANF. The local leadership teams address systems and operational topics related to service delivery issues and improvements, implementation of programs, processes, and current initiatives, program and center performance, sector strategy implementation, business recruitment services, and implementation of local area strategic plans as they relate to center functions. The local leadership teams also serve as a communication mechanism between regional, local area, and center levels. WSO operational standards support the direction of WIOA, as well as the expectations of the Governor and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. The standards foster mechanisms to better align resources across partners and agencies in an effort to provide the most customer-centered services possible. The expectations of staff within WorkSource Oregon, as outlined in the WSO operational standards, are numerous. The opportunities for each of us to have a positive impact on our workplace, our workforce system, and our communities are even greater in number. As representatives of Oregon's workforce system, we need to continually strive to uphold the values and guiding principles of WorkSource Oregon. To be human-centered, valuing others and ourselves as unique individuals. To be open to collaboration and the free exchange of ideas.
Right.
To strive for excellence for all customers and ourselves.
Okay,
we are a system of effective teams.
I don't want to disappoint you. I'm going to cut it off right there.
I was just getting into that.
What happens in the end?
Well, here's
the movie end.
Oh, a cliffhanger. Oh,
wow. I tell you, I knew you'd feel that way. And so I've asked Laura to email the site to you so you can review it anytime.
Isn't it on there? It's
already on
the dance floor here.
I do want to say one thing real quick. This is just a reinforce. This is talking about the OWIB system.
Right.
There are four or five, so BOLI, DHS, Youth Development Commission, and somebody else, the Blind, Commission for the Blind, all do similar things. So that's what we're going to try to look at. So these are like the big dog in the show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then there's the others that we're going to look at all of them, see how they play together. So thank you for your patience, your indulgence. I knew you'd be excited to hear about this. And if I don't see you, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Oh, and I'm closing this informational hearing.
I think Carl Wilson should thank you.
Mary.
I think Carl Wilson should thank you.
Closing this informational